Who would have lived at the Ness of Brodgar?
Is the famous rock art the Brodgar butterfly really a butterfly?
And where did all the stone come from to build the Neolithic structures on Orkney?
It's a Ness of Brodgar questions and answers special edition of the Time Team podcast.
Yes, hello and welcome to the Time Team podcast with Helen Geek and Martin Williams. I'm sitting at home while Martin, lucky chap, is still in Orkney, those islands just off the north coast of Scotland, where Time Team's been digging at the iconic Neolithic site of the Ness of Brodgar.
Yes, and I am still in the kitchen, really. I'm in the kitchen of the house which sits on the top of the Ness of Brodgar. I can see just over in the distance, probably about 100 metres away, the site where the excavations are going on right now. I think there's a tour going on at the moment, I can see. So members of the public have been turning up, and twice a day they get given a good old talking to. They get shown around the site, shown the original excavations, which are now covered over, and then shown the dig that's going on at the moment as I can see it. They had the opportunity to visit the Time Team shop and the Ness of Brodgar shop so they can buy some merchandise if they want to remember their visit and support the archaeology that's going on. And so many people, coachload after coachload, have been coming past because this little spit of land where I am at the moment, sandwiched between two bodies of water, lock on one side, lock on the other, with the rolling hills in the distance, this is just teeming with history. There's the ring of Brodgar just a little further away from me. Behind me is the stones of Stenness. There's Maze Howe, this burial mound just off to my right across the water. So I'm really standing right in the middle of it. But here I am, where the archaeologists come to make their cups of tea and have a little break when they come in from the cold and the wind and the rain. So that might happen in just a moment, and we can see who we bump into. The reason that Time Team is here, of course, you'll remember, is to investigate that amazing bit of geophysics that our very own John Gator discovered, the circular anomaly, as John called it, these blobs that made this circle with a very intriguing large blob in the middle. We're trying to get to the bottom of what that actually is. There's been a number of theories, but we don't quite know. That is what I'm doing here, and I've been having an absolutely brilliant time doing it.
That sounds marvellous, Martin. I'm so jealous of you sitting here in Suffolk, where it isn't even really particularly warm, but never mind. This week, we have a chance for Time Team members to ask questions about the Ness, which you might not have had an answer to yet. And with Martin in Orkney is someone who might be able to help answer those questions. It's Anne Mitchell, one of the site directors for the excavation. Hello, Anne.
Hello, Helen.
Hello. How's it going so far?
It's going well, but it's going strangely. It's not doing those things that we expect the Ness to do after 20 years of digging elsewhere on the Ness. And that's really intriguing and interesting. And that's the fun of archaeology, isn't it? Just looking out for what on earth it's going to throw you and what might yet come.
What do you mean then? So what has been different from the other excavations that have happened here?
So I've been the find supervisor at the Ness for a very long time now, and I'm used to dealing with that job with masses and masses of material being flung at us, coming in trayload after trayload, from tiny bits of burnt bone right through to great big fabulous slabs of decorated stonework. And that's just not happening. We're getting teaspoonfuls of burnt bone, tiny bits of flint, most of it not worked, and very, very little else. Pottery is one of the big, big features of the Ness story. We have a humongous amount of grooved ware has come out over the years. And I don't think we've got 10 sherds out over the last 2.5 weeks. So from that point of view, it's been very, very different. Very different.
Okay, that's really... do we know why that might be?
It's got to be something to do with the structure and what the structure is. And why it's there and why it's so denuded of stonework as well, because it's, you know, it's very, very shallow what we're finding by comparison to the sort of a metre or more high of archaeology walling that we found elsewhere on the site. So something different has happened there. Either it's been different in its origins or it's become different because it's been robbed out whatever the answer to that is. But we've let them keep digging and see whether we can solve all of that.
Well, that's it. And that is exactly what Time Team is here to do. What's it like, by the way, having Time Team here in invading this quite small space, really, in order to try and fit everybody in to do the work we need to do?
I have to say that over the years, we've had quite a few television companies in and around us, and we've had Time Team before. We've known John for a very long time, and you're all very familiar to us from watching Time Team and so on. So in actual fact, it's been quite jolly. It's been quite all right.
Well, I just wish I was there with you. It sounds like you're having such a lovely time, and it epitomises how archaeological excavations are often these little closely knit communities that are so friendly and so warm. And here I am sitting miles away, not being able to see you and see what's going on. And I'm just so grateful to be able to have this little snapshot of the podcast that lets me be part of it too.
We would have loved you to have been here and to have shown you Orkney, because I understand that you've never been in Orkney. And I think that you would probably... I can't think of an archaeologist who doesn't love Orkney and ooh and ah at every turn. No, the whole business with Time Team has been wonderful. It's allowed us to do this. It's allowed us to explore this anomaly, which we have had to explore. It's a jolly good thing, as I say.
Yes, I'll look very much forward to seeing the programme when it comes out, because the I've seen the geophysics, fantastic and remarkable, but to see how it fits into the whole site is going to be really exciting. But Anne, I should say, though, are you ready for some questions from Time Team members? Because I could probably talk to you all day, but we have a few questions that are going to be much more interesting than anything I could think up.
Let's have the questions.
Okay, so question one is from Debbie Gerlock. And Debbie says, watching the Ness of Brodgar, how much has the landmass and shoreline changed since Neolithic times? And this is something that absolutely fascinates me, because one of the reasons that I haven't been able to come up to Orkney was that I actually had a holiday booked, ironically, in northwest Scotland. And I've been swimming in lochs over the last couple of weeks and looking at the shore and looking at the tides and wondering myself how, given the geology that is so tough and hard in northern Scotland, I've been asking myself exactly the same question that Debbie has. What is the change in the hill slopes and the landscapes, but also in the underneath the water landscapes? Has the sea level risen, fallen? What are the differences?
The sea level has changed, but probably not hugely. The one loch, the loch to the west side of the site, has become saline. The sea started to come in sort of early Neolithic, pre-Neolithic. And on the east side, the Loch of Harry, it's a freshwater loch. The levels they've not changed that much, but the sea level has risen a bit. And it would have been a much marshier, boggier landscape, we think, in the early days. But it's not changed that much. The isthmus hasn't become much wider. And I think the other aspect of it is that the isthmus, that great finger of land that comes down between the two lochs, must, I think, have something to do with the fact that people came and used this area, because it is so significant from the low hills that surround the two lochs. Looking down on it, it's very, very dramatic. And as I say, that really hasn't changed that much. And the other aspect of it as well, I suppose, is that the rock of Orkney is much more sandstone and rather than hard granite, gneiss and so on. So it's a much softer rolling landscape than you will have been seeing on the northwest of Scotland.
And can I ask a little supplementary one to that? Because you hear so much about how Orkney doesn't have trees. Has it never had trees?
It has changed greatly in that respect, and it probably started to change during the Neolithic, and it probably started to change because of humans farming in that landscape. The pollen, the carbonised plant remains and so on all speak of a landscape in which hazel, alder, birch, but also oak and pine will have existed. And so it will have been fairly wooded, but not to the extent perhaps of further south, because you do have, you know, you are in a marine world where you do have big winds coming through. But yes, it has been much more wooded. And as I say, that change probably starts to take place in the Neolithic as farming, big pasture land, big grazing herds and flocks start to move across that landscape.
And I would say, Helen, that it's not that there are no trees at all here. I mean, I'm looking out the window and I can see some just across the lot. There's the odd one or two, but they all look like relatively new trees. They're quite small. You don't get any big, mighty oaks or anything like that that would have been here for, you know, 400, 500 years. These are almost bushes, aren't they? I think it's fair to say, Anne.
Yes, it tends to be willow and alder and plants like that that grow vigorously, and they can put an incredible amount of growth on in one summer, and then the winter comes and knocks it right back. And we do have quite big stands of trees in particular areas where they have massed together. But yes, I think a lot of it is wind, but a lot of it is farming as well.
Interesting. Thank you very much.
It just does make for a really different landscape, doesn't it? When you look out, as someone is so used to just seeing big trees everywhere they go, you look across this landscape with the rolling hills and not really a tree in sight, save for just a few little small pockets of very, very small ones that you can just see there on the other side of the lot. As, by the way, the rain starts to come in, I could just see the mist starting to come across, or a shower start to come across. There's a word for that, isn't there? I learned a new word the other day. Was it scubby? A scubby?
There are lots and lots of words for rain. If you were to pick up an old Orcadian dictionary, you would be amazed at the number of words for rain and for wind. What's coming across just now is smur. So smur is very, 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 very thin rain, which will disappear fairly quickly. A scubby shower is one that dances away and across the landscape even faster than smur.
I love all these words. This is so, so great. Let's move on to another question, shall we? And this one comes from Jeremy, who says, clearly the population of Orkney in the Neolithic must have numbered in the thousands to build these structures. Well, actually, we learned about this a couple of weeks ago, didn't we? Speaking to Nick Card about how the Neolithic population might have been up to, what, 35,000, something like that, which is far greater than it is today, or a little bit greater anyway. It's what, about 20, 23,000, something like that at the moment. But the only stone-built residences, Skara Brae and Barnhouse, could not have accommodated them all. So, do you think it's possible that these stone-built structures were the exclusive residences of priest kings and their attendants, while the ordinary people lived in wooden turf roundhouses or longhouses that haven't been preserved archaeologically? So I suppose the basic question is there, where were all these 35,000 people living?
I think they were living all over Orkney, in places that have not been preserved, because that stone has been endlessly, endlessly recycled. When my niece, who is now 35, was a little girl, she said, Auntie Anne, why is there only one Skara Brae? And I said, you look at all the barns, all the houses, all the dikes, everything that exists in stone in Orkney, and we still use building stone a lot. It has been recycled and recycled and recycled. And I think that Skara Brae exists because the sand engulfed it. The Ness of Brodgar exists because I think it was so stony that people, they robbed out a certain amount, but then they stopped robbing it out. It was too difficult. It was too much. But I think that there are plenty evidence of masses and masses of other places which have been more or less completely robbed out, or they've subsequently been ploughed out and they've disappeared. And I suspect that when people lived in Orkney in the Neolithic, they were living in stone houses such as Skara Brae, such as Barnhouse, and all the other places that we've just no longer can find. But there is also a huge amount of Orkney that's never been geophysicked. We don't know what is all there. A huge programme a few years ago, worked on by one of our other directors, Mark Edmonds, they did a whole geophysical programme right across the World Heritage Site of the heart of Neolithic Orkney. And that's an astonishing array of archaeology that's just waiting to be looked at some time in the future.
I must say, the geophysics to me looks very difficult to work out from a Southern English perspective because it's stone on stone on stone. And it looks like a big muddle to me. You really need to know what you're looking at.
Yes, and I think John's experience in that and experience, you know, Mark and Nick have been digging and looking at the Ness and, you know, geophysical survey of other places for years and years and years. And that's where their knowledge and John's experience all comes into it. And even then, you're left scratching your head. And the answer is picking where you're going to dig really, really carefully.
Yeah, that's it. You've got to know your stuff, and you've got to have had the experience that people like you and like John and like, and you referenced there, Nick and Mark, who the other site directors have had. You've got to know this landscape and have lived in it to understand a little bit more about the sorts of places people would have lived and things like that. Brilliant questions so far. Thank you very much to Jeremy, and thank you to Debbie. Coming up in just a moment here on the Time Scene podcast, a question about what I think is one of the iconic symbols of this site, the Brodgar butterfly. We're going to talk about that next.
This is the Time Team podcast with Helen Geek at home and Martin Williams at the Ness of Brodgar on Orkney, along with Anne Mitchell, one of the site directors for the excavation that's going on there at the moment.
Yes, and we are sitting at the moment in the kitchen. I'm surprised because as we're recording this right now, it is getting close to lunchtime. There haven't been people coming in to make their cups of tea yet. I feel a little bit left out. It would be quite nice to see some other friendly faces. There's a basket here full of biscuits and things like that, which I'm very tempted to just dip into later, but I wouldn't want to deprive the archaeologists, who are definitely doing more hardy work than I am, just sitting in a kitchen. But the views that I have are incredible, Helen. They really are. Looking across, I was talking about that rain that was coming in a moment ago. Now, all of a sudden, I mean, it's only been about 3 minutes and the sun is starting to come out. So the weather is ever changing, and you can imagine, therefore, it's just the topic of conversation all the time. Yesterday, the wind was blowing like you won't believe. Today, so much more calm. It is fascinating, an amazing place, and you can just feel like there are so many stories here, one of which we are trying to tell with the excavation that we're doing here on the Ness of Brodgar. The other thing I noticed quite a lot of, Anne, are people coming past. There's lots of tourists, and you also get a lot of tourist coaches that are coming past. People are coming here from all over the world. How known do you think this site is beyond the Northern Isles, beyond Scotland, indeed?
Certainly when we were digging, people came from all across the world. I mean, people came, as I say, America, from Europe, you name it, people arrived here. And I think that one of the things that you're seeing happening here is there is a very big cruise ship in Kirkwall today. And cruise ships are a big feature of our summers nowadays. And these take passengers and out they go on buses, and they go to Scarabree, they come through the heart of Neolithic Orkney, they go up to the Ring of Brodgar. They tend not to stop at the Ness of Brodgar because that's an influx of people that we just couldn't handle or deal with. But those busloads of people are a big feature of summers in Orkney. And I suspect there'll be 4, maybe 5 big ships in this week. I think next to Southampton, it's one of the big cruise ship destinations of Europe.
Yeah, well, you do see that. And Kirkwall, when you walk through Kirkwall, you know, when the ships are in town, I've been there. Sometimes you can't move for people. There's loads and loads and loads of people that come in, which I suppose is a double-edged sword, in that I'm sure that maybe puts a strain on how people can cope here. But also it is bringing people here and allowing them to learn about the history. What do you think makes them want to come? Why are people drawn to this place?
A large part of it is the archaeology. Scarabree, Maze Howe are, you know, places of world renown. And people want to come and see that. I think islands, people love coming to islands. I think nature, and just the fact that our landscape is so different, I think that's what brings people here. I'm not sure that some of them thoroughly enjoy it. Yesterday was a bit of a strain on everybody. But, you know, there's plenty evidence that people do then come back and want to enjoy it and to come here and sort of, you know, drill down into it that little bit more. So Yes.
Speaking of drilling down, let's get some questions, and a couple of questions actually that have come in on the Brodgar butterfly, which is this piece of rock art. Looks like a butterfly, some very straight lines, actually. And we were learning about rock art a few weeks ago, weren't we, on the podcast, and learning that it's quite unique here in Orkney because of these straight vertical and horizontal lines. But anyway, this particular one looks like a butterfly, and it is really symbolic of this area. Anya says, hi there from Norway. Oh, you're just across the water there in Norway. We're closer to Norway at the moment than we are to London. This Brodgar butterfly motif is haunting my dreams, says Anya. In a good way, of course. The cross reminds me of a cardinal cross, and the slightly curved sides bear a slight resemblance to the structure that was found outside the main excavation. Okay, that's here, and this was Structure T. Yes, I have read about Structure T. Could there be a connection, says Anya. And Andrew Stewart has got in touch and says, while I guess we'll never know, could the Brodgar butterfly be symbolic of possible celestial observations and site-related celebrations? Specifically, the figure of eight pattern could represent the pattern that the sun traces in the sky over the course of a year. So lots of intrigue, lots of mystery around the Brodgar butterfly. And what do you know about it?
It's a symbol which recurs into a finer and sometimes to a coarser extent throughout the stone that we find on the site. Sometimes it can be quite small, sometimes it's that bit bigger, sometimes deeper, and sometimes that bit more, as I say, just a larger presence. I'm going to dodge all of the interpretations because I think that we really can't and don't know, but I'm very happy for people to look at these things and observe and set it within the facts that surround and see if they can come up with ideas. The celestial idea is probably that follows through in lots of ways within the archaeology of Orkney and elsewhere in the Neolithic. I think that we have to be careful of imposing our ideas and of imposing our interpretations or the way that we view things onto the past. And I quite like just looking at them for the way that they are and not spending too much time trying to work out what they mean, because I don't think, short of actually speaking to a person who drew one, that we're ever really going to understand what they mean, because they possibly meant different things to different people at different times. And one of the things that we don't know is at over what length of period at the Ness of Brodgar, which is in use for over 1,000 years, are people making that symbol? And as I say, does it change over the time that we're seeing it being represented at the Ness of Brodgar?
Yes, that's all so fascinating, isn't it? I'm always intrigued by how different individual people today interpret these things. And of course, because it's different today, as you say, Anne, it could just as well have been equally different with different people in the past. One of the things that I'd like to know, actually, as I'm down here in Suffolk and you're up there, which way is your window facing? Where are you looking out? Are you looking out towards the west?
No, we're looking out towards east, sort of southeast-ish.
Right. So you'd have had to be up incredibly early to see the sunrise. So I'm imagining that you were all in bed at that point. It was probably about 4 o'clock in the morning. But a treeless, open landscape does focus your mind on sunrise and sunset, doesn't it? Because you can actually see the sun disappearing, whereas in my leafy village, you hardly notice it's happening because your vision is always funneled upwards by the trees.
I think you make a really good point, because you become, and you hear people who come to live in Orkney talking about this, that their life becomes much more focused on the sky and the changes in the sky and what the sky is going to tell them about what the weather is going to do. But the sky is telling them just about what time of year we're at. I can take the example of my house, which basically faces north-south. And in the winter, I can, you know, it's a very, very short span of light that we have, and the sun is setting a way, way round to the sort of southwest. And at this time of year, it's almost setting towards the north. It's a huge arc of transition that takes place. And it's absolutely fascinating watching it. And then once the sky starts getting dark again overnight and we're watching the moon and the stars, that again becomes a great focus of your attention. And of course, one of the great hobbies in Orkney is the nights that you're going to see the Merry Dancers, or Northern Lights as you would call them. And that brings people out in their dozens and hundreds trying to photograph and watch. And so our lives do focus on the sky a great deal more, certainly than they would in an urban setting.
Yes, and that's something that us holidaymakers who only come north in the summer, we never experience. I'm going to have to do some winter holidays, I think.
Yes, I think you are. And especially, yes, as I say, things like the phenomena like the Northern Lights are wonderful. Can't guarantee them at any particular night or any particular time. But when they do happen, it's something that does make you gasp. It does something that's absolutely wonderful to behold and sometimes even to hear. So that's pretty special.
To hear with your ears?
To hear, yes. They sometimes crackle and pop.
Wow. Gosh, that is something that I didn't know. Wow, I can't imagine how brilliant that must be in such a quiet place as Orkney as well.
Yes, it is pretty special.
Now, we better move on to the next question, which is from Jacob. Oh, and this links to what I was asking earlier on about trees on Orkney. And Jacob asks, what are the current accepted ideas considered by the team about the relationships between absence of forests and the prevalence of ancient stone building around the time of the Nessa Brodgar? Is there a lack of wood construction, or is it a lack of preserved evidence? What's the answer to that one, Anne?
In the earliest Neolithic of Orkney, people were building in wood, and they were building in wood which could have come from what was growing in Orkney at the time, as we discussed earlier. But also one of the big features of an island is what bounces in on the sea, what comes in on the tide. And driftwood would have been accumulating in the Neolithic, as it has done throughout history until the arrival of container shipping. Wood has bounced up, along with all sorts of other goodies, onto the shores and has been gathered and collected and reused again and again and again. So we know from the archaeology that people were building in wood. We know that there was wood in use in the early stages at the Nessa Brodgar. But we also know that the transition then was made, as we can see again from the archaeology, to stone. And we also know that what happens in Orkney doesn't happen to the same extent, for example, in Caithness, which is very much the same geology. So there's a choice, there's a build-up of skill and knowledge and understanding happening in Orkney that makes people decide that they're going to go increasingly with stone. And they're doing things here that they're not doing elsewhere, but which they would have been able to do had they so desired.
Given that you say that, it's just suddenly made me remember, of course, that one of the things that you need wood for is to make boats and ships. And obviously, if you're living in Orkney, you are going to need those for travel as well as for fishing. So do we know anything about the boat building tradition ideally at the time of Nessa Brodgar in the Neolithic, but later on, how are people accessing the wood they need for boat building?
They're certainly needing to build boats, but again, it's one of these things that we have no evidence for in the Neolithic, i.e. we haven't got anything that's left from boats of the day. But clearly, that's how they're getting back and forth. There's no land bridge. There's no other way of doing it. It's probably the most efficient way of getting between around the coast of Orkney, never mind going back and forth between the different islands. But no, we haven't got anything wonderful, log canoes or plank-built boats or anything like that. But we know, you know, that obviously the master sailors of Orkney's past are the Vikings, when they come cutting their way across the sea from Norway and build phenomenal ships, of which we know quite a lot. But no, we don't have anything preserved from the Neolithic.
I'm going to butt in here and say that things are starting to happen in the kitchen, Helen, because archaeologists are coming in and they're starting to make their tea. Danny Wootton's here. Hello.
Hello. It's dinner time.
It's dinner time.
Just coming to put the kettle on.
Oh, no, go for it. Put the kettle on. We'll have one. Helen says hello as well. We are pretty much ready to finish here, I would say. I just have this one question, Anne, from a different Anne, who says, do we know when and where items and learning from the Ness will be be displayed. So basically, where is this information available for people to learn more about?
At the moment, website. And that's what we're doing, a lot of work on the website, and we've got a tremendous amount of information on it. Until such time as we publish what we've, our researchers from this site, until such time as we publish, the material that we have will stay within our keeping, and ultimately it will then go to a museum somewhere in Scotland. We hope very much that that will be in Orkney. And at that point, we hand it over to the museum and they will start displaying and doing work with it. But at the minute, we are working on all of the material. And as we make discoveries and we make exciting discoveries in post-excavation every week, keep visiting the website www.nessabrodger.co.uk.
There you go. And of course, as always, we're going to keep you up to date with stuff right here on the Time Team podcast and on Patreon as well, if you're a Time Team member. That is about it, I think, from the Ness this week, as we make way. Jackie's just walked in as well, getting a cup of tea,
after hard time.
I can hear, is that the kettle boiling? Yeah.
Yes, that is the kettle boiling in the background, you can hear as well. So tea and lunch is very much happening right now. So we're going to love you and leave you and say, Anne, thank you very much indeed for spending time with us on the podcast and brilliant answers to some questions, and we'll let you get back to your very important work. Thank you. Next week then, final podcast from the Ness of Brodgar. You'll be able to see what I've been getting up to here, because we're going to be on YouTube. Interviews with Sir Tony Robinson, John Gator, loads and loads of people who are working non-stop to understand the mysteries of the Ness of Brodgar.
Yes, and don't forget that it's your support that makes digging at the Ness of Brodgar and countless other sites around the country possible. Being a Time Team member means you're supporting the archaeology that we do and the programmes we make. And you also get loads of benefits, including updates on the digs as they happen, masterclasses, behind-the-scenes videos, ad-free episodes and bonus podcasts. Head to patreon.com/timeteamofficial right now to become a Time Team member and to get even more from Time Team.
And I'll speak to you next week. Until next time, thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye.